Let's see if targeting pharyngeal gonorrhea will help us out. And so I'm really delighted to introduce somebody who needs no introduction to this group, and that's Professor David Lewis, who is the president of IUSTI and the co-chair of this meeting. He's also the head of the Center for HIV and STIs at the National Institute of Communicable Diseases in Johannesburg. And Dr. Lewis is going to be talking about management of oropharyngeal gonorrhea. Is it crucial to prevent the emergence of drug resistance?
Thank you very much, Khalil, and thanks very much to the organizers for letting me talk about one of my own pet subjects. I think the short answer is we don't know the answer to this question, but I'm going to show you some slides which I hope will convince you that I think it really is an important issue for us to consider. The outline of my presentation will first of all discuss the nature of oropharyngeal gonorrhea. We'll look at the prevalence and incidence of oropharyngeal infections in MSM. We'll discuss briefly diagnostic approaches and challenges. We'll look at MSM networks and how important they are for antimicrobial resistance. Lewis has already shown you some slides in that respect. Discuss again genetic exchange between Neisseria species and look at decreased susceptibility and resistance to extended spectrum cephalosporins. And finally, a few pharmacological issues just to finish off the talk. So first of all, I want to talk about the question, is oropharyngeal gonorrhea, a Neisseria gonorrhea, a colonizer or a pathogen? So some of you in the room, I hope most of you will realize that these infections are actually quite self-limited. There was a study in 1979 by Wallin and Siegel that they looked at 17 patients, a mixture of men and women, with proven oropharyngeal gonorrhea, and they were left untreated and followed up for up to 12 weeks. And they cultured them regularly, and what they found is by 6 weeks that only 41% of them were still culture positive, and at 12 weeks all of them had become culture negative. A larger series was reported in 1986 by Hutt and Frank Judson, on 60 patients. That was a mixture of MSM and women with oropharyngeal gonorrhea. They had their repeat cultures taken from the point of diagnosis when they came back for their treatment. So before treatment was given, another culture was taken. And that happened between 2 and 7 days after the initial culture. And they saw by 7 days, as short as that, almost 60% of the pharyngeal infections had cleared spontaneously based on culture. Importantly, that paper also showed that gonococci are readily detected in expectorated saliva, and that obviously has importance for sexual transmission. There you go. So there's a very nice case report. It's a little old now, but 1974. But this was a report which does provide quite strong evidence, I would suggest, for the transfer of pharyngitis by kissing. The first case and the second case were partners, a 20-year-old man, case one, and a 19-year-old female, his regular partner, case two. And you can see that in May, the young man was presenting with urethral gonorrhea. While she was at the GP having recurrent sore throats that were being treated inappropriately. And the GP, of course, wasn't thinking about gonorrhea or oral sex because we don't think about oral sex as sex. We're still struggling with that one. He came back and still had, even after treatment, got reinfected. Eventually the partner came in. She was found to be negative in the cervix but positive at the throat. And at that point she didn't want to admit to oral sex, and it took a long time for the doctor and the nurses to get that case, the history from that particular lady. He then came back and was negative at the urethra, but now positive at the throat. And she was adamant that since she had been treated, that there was only going to be kissing that took place. And he then got pharyngitis. So I mean, it's as best you can to get evidence that kissing can actually pass on this infection. So having said that, let us move over to MSM, because this is really where the issue is at its largest. There are several reasons to detect and treat pharyngeal gonorrhea. Particularly, it's important for urethral gonorrhea. It's a key risk factor in this population. It also can cause pharyngitis and tonsillitis in a minority of the patients, and it can be an important source of the gonococcus for disseminated gonococcal infection. The rates of pharyngeal gonorrhea do vary between surveys. There's a mixture of surveys here amongst men attending HIV clinics, STD clinics, anonymous testing sites and bathhouses. And reports have gone between 3 and 15% of MSM having positive Neisseria gonorrhea cultures from their throats. Perhaps one of the best studies to look at this has been the EXPLORE study. You can see here in the blue box. And in San Francisco, there was an ancillary study on this. Basically, it was a behavioral study, but they started to look at throat carriage of Neisseria gonorrhea over just over a two-year period between 2001 and 2003. And they found that the prevalence was 5.5% of positive swabs for Neisseria gonorrhea amongst these MSM, over nearly 2,500 samples taken. And the incidence worked out about 11.2 cases per 100 person years. And importantly, they were able to do some more epidemiological analysis, and they showed that younger age, as well as insertive oral sex partners in the last 3 months, the number that you had, the larger the number, the more the risk, were predictors of having pharyngeal gonorrhea. And also importantly, they showed that having ejaculation into your throat didn't increase the risk. We also know from the MSM prevalence monitoring project that goes on here in the US in 5 public health STD clinics and 3 community-based MSM health clinics, that there is an important difference between HIV positive and HIV negative MSM. And at all sites, the prevalence of gonorrhea in the HIV positives is higher. So this again raises concern for HIV prevention efforts. And you can also see, as Lewis pointed out, that rectal and pharyngeal gonorrhea account for a large proportion of the total gonorrhea cases. And if they're not tested for, you may not even pick them up. In terms of culture, it's traditionally the gold standard for diagnosis and has very high specificity. The big advantages we all appreciate is that you can test the cultured organisms for their antimicrobial susceptibility. It has very high sensitivity in symptomatic men with urethritis, but lower sensitivity in women and asymptomatic patients. Julie Schachter reported a low sensitivity for culture compared to NATS on testing the oropharyngeal samples. I think this is a very important study. Looked at over 1,100 MSM, and amongst those MSM, 89 cases of oropharyngeal gonorrhea were detected, but culture was only 41% sensitive compared to 72% with Becton Dickinson's ProbeTec and 82% with Hologic's Aptima Combo 2. And it's important to realize that performance of culture is very much affected by both specimen collection and the transport conditions. The specimen collection has been looked at recently in a paper in sexually transmitted infections from Kit Fairley's team in Melbourne, and they reported, and it was a nice study, to show that more widespread swabbing, particularly covering the oropharynx, which tends to cause the gag reflex, which many people would avoid to avoid the gag, and it's important not just to sample the tonsils, and they showed that they could pick up better rates of pharyngeal gonorrhea when they had a more widespread sampling. There are diagnostic challenges for picking up pharyngeal gonorrhea with the NATS, so that yes, they're more sensitive, but it's important to realize that several bacteria, different Neisseria species, can cross-react with the gonococcal NAT targets. And it's also important to understand that these cross-reactions depend on which target you're looking at in your assay, because the rate of genetic exchange is very much gene-dependent. So some assays, as described here, for example, the Cobas Amplicor or the ProbeTec, or some in-house PCRs, for example, that use the CPPB target, that they do have problems with cross-reactions. And it's less of a problem with those NATs which use OPA genes, for example, the Abbott Realtime and the previous ligase chain reaction assay that we had, as well as the Aptima assays using the ribosomal RNA genes and in-house PORA pseudogene assays. It's also important to understand that these are non-gonococcal Neisseria account for less than 1% of all Neisseria species in the urogenital tract, but they are more common in the anorectal area and particularly more common in the oropharynx. So for sampling the throat, it does become a big issue. So it's generally recommended that if you're going to sample throat samples with NAT tests, you should make sure that you have the right assay targeting the right target to make sure you don't have problems with cross-reactions. And also to understand, if you want to repeat testing, you shouldn't use the same assay again, but try and use an assay with a different target, otherwise you'll just get the same result. MSM networks are very important on antimicrobial resistance, and to survive within such networks, the gonococci need to be able to colonize and infect a variety of mucosal surfaces. Now, these surfaces do vary in respect of the presence and nature and concentration of inhibitory hydrophobic molecules. And the variation in the host environments can be translated into selection of gonococci with certain outer membrane protein phenotypes, which in turn can reduce susceptibility to antimicrobial agents. And it was quite a while ago, 1982, that Steve Morse wrote a very nice paper looking at Neisseria gonorrhea isolates that have been collected from the anorectal areas and compared them to the urethral areas. And basically, from the rectal sites, he saw a lot more chromosomal resistance to penicillin and erythromycin, because these MTR-associated mutations were helping the bacteria survive in what was a very hydrophobic environment with a lot of fatty acids around. There was also an association with the W2 sero group, again showing that there's a selection by anatomical site for certain survival of certain Neisseria gonorrhea. Lewis already showed a graph for ciprofloxacin. I've got here examples, graphs of ciprofloxacin on your left and cefixime on the right. These are the UK data. I think you saw the GRASP data, the GISP data from the US. These are the United Kingdom's GRASP data from Public Health England. And they've shown very nicely that if you look at gonococcal prevalence of resistance to cipro or else decreased susceptibility to extended spectrum cephalosporins, the prevalence of resistance is much higher amongst MSM, that's the red line, compared to the heterosexual males and women, which are the blue and green, respectively. Commensal pathogenic Neisseria, as I mentioned, that they're quite common to live together in the throat, and there are at least 8 human-adapted commensal species. And you can see here the phylogenetic tree. I'll just point out for in a minute. I can't see, but at the very top you can see a Neisseria elongata, which is probably ancestrally the most distant from Neisseria gonorrhea. But what it appears to be is that the pathogenic Neisseria meningitidis and Neisseria gonorrhea emerged from the commensal Neisseria over time, and that there's been sharing of virulence alleles between both of them, and now we know sharing of genes or partial parts of genes which can account for antimicrobial resistance. So there's some lovely work going on at the University of Arizona by Maggie So. I just wanted to quickly show you some pictures. She's been studying gonococcal type 4 pili, which are very important. These are these, let's see, we'll have another go with this. It's dead. You can see at the bottom of the picture the strands that are coming out of this group of Neisseria gonorrhea in that big bundle. And once they attach to that, they allow the organisms to attach to the mucosal surface, and then they retract. And that retraction is very important for DNA uptake and genetic transformation. And this retraction has a number of other effects, which includes allowing these Neisseria gonorrhea to crawl over surfaces and snuggle up next to other Neisseria. And you'll see a picture of that in a moment. If you've never seen Neisseria species snuggling up, today is the day for you. Enables also the aggregation of bacterial cells into these microcolonies. And you can see here Neisseria elongata, that's the rod-looking one over on your left-hand side, and then the bundle of Neisseria gonorrhea, that's all stuck together as well. And that Neisseria gonorrhea bundle has kind of walked over and is now talking to the Neisseria elongata. And while it talks, it exchanges DNA. And this DNA donation is thought probably to occur from death of cells, but also Neisseria gonorrhea has a type 4 secretion system. Some of the strains, at least, can pump out DNA into the environment. And there's a very complicated process which I won't go through, but it's been very nicely described by scientists from the US, looking at how the DNA is taken up by a receptor and then taken across through the outer membrane, through the periplasm, and then through the inner membrane, the cell membrane, and then one strand of DNA is pumped into the cell. And we know that the commensal mitochondria are incredibly important. I just want to point out here, the second bullet point, that use of macrolides can increase the carriage of the ERMB macrolide we know in oral streptococci for 180 days or more just from one single dose. So giving antibiotics for anything, chest infections or so forth, can create a lot of problems. You saw something like this in Lewis's talk. This is just to bring out the point with the extended spectrum cephalosporins. The top rectangle, the white one, is a fully sensitive Neisseria gonorrhoeae strain. The one below is a strain that has a mosaic penicillin binding protein, and you can see every time there's amino acid change compared to the resistant to the sensitive one, you've got a dark line. And then you have the same sequence from Neisseria cinerea and Neisseria perflava, and you can see patterns of where there are identical amino acid changes, really suggesting that there has been exchange of DNA on a large scale. So it's not surprising that this HO41 isolate that Lewis referred to appeared, first of all, in the oropharynx of a female sex worker, and that happened in 2009. So in terms of treatment outcomes, and this is my last slide, oropharyngeal infections are less easy to cure regardless of the treatment regimen. Moran did a very nice systematic review in 1995, looking at over 16,000 cases of uncomplicated gonorrhea and 144 reports of the trials, looking at 87 antimicrobial regimens. And most of the infections, over 96%, were cured satisfactorily. But he did manage to show quite nicely that the cure rates were significantly lower in the oropharynx of both men at about 79% and women at about 84% compared with the other sites. And these differences remain significant even after stratifying for the drugs that were given. And this differential cure rate may reflect the inability of antimicrobials to reach sufficient extracellular concentrations in the tonsillar and other pharyngeal tissues as a result of minimal mucosal inflammation that occurs with colonization, the plasma half-life, and the tissue persistence of the drugs. And this is my final point. I think that really going forward, if we're going to do clinical trials on gonorrhea treatment, we really must look at the throat, because this is the key area where we're going to see treatment failure. So in conclusion, I'd just like to reiterate that the pharyngeal infections with gonorrhea are normally transient, but they are an important source of transmission and may result in complications. NAT testing has the highest sensitivity for detection, but does not allow for antimicrobial susceptibility testing. Genetic exchange, hopefully I've shown you, occurs commonly and very closely between Neisseria gonorrhea and commensal Neisseria, and that allows the emergence of new resistant patterns like we saw with the cephalosporins, that we must look at the oropharynx with future trials. And I go back to the question, the impact of better management of oropharyngeal gonorrhea on the emergence and dissemination of antimicrobial resistant infections, it's likely that it's going to be very, very important, but we haven't yet got the proof for that, and we need to do more studies. With that, thank you very much.